7:33. Looking ahead a little bit, Tuesday partly sunny and pleasant, 30% chance of rain, a high of 78. Wednesday, a high of 71. Thursday, 75. And then we start to climb again. Friday, 83. Saturday and Sunday, 89. Here are the numbers now. Humidity at 70%, wind northwest at 3. 66 degrees Kenosha, 64 in Racine, 60 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is up in about a minute.
I have found myself deeply engrossed and, for that matter, profoundly troubled by a very important new book titled The Injustice of Place, Uncovering the Legacy of Poverty in America. It was undertaken by three different authors, including my morning show guest, Catherine Eden, the William Church Osborne Professor of Sociology and Public Affairs at Princeton University. This is an examination of the reality, the harsh reality of poverty in the United States, but examined in a little different way. And these three authors who undertook this book began studying poverty in a different way. And we'll kind of explore with Catherine Eden exactly the way in which they went about this. But in a nutshell, they came to an understanding of how certain places in America, certain settings in America, were particularly prone to poverty and to being places of deep, entrenched disadvantage. And they wanted to look at this through this particular lens and try to understand why poverty had taken root, taken hold in these places with such a firm grip, and also how it could be in sometimes very sharp contrast to nearby places that were quite affluent, or sometimes in contrast to certain affluence in its own past. And what emerges is a really fascinating and important new understanding of the root causes of poverty, and a clearer awareness of just how much inequality is part of the American story, and what perhaps we can do about it. The book is published by Mariner Books. Again, it's titled The Injustice of Place, Uncovering the Legacy of Poverty in America. And Professor Catherine Eden, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I wonder if you could tell me, first of all, how you first became interested in matters related to poverty. Is this something that right from the start has been a concern of yours, and is that what led you into this field? I mean, to this academic discipline, or was it while being part of this academic discipline that you came to understand poverty as a really compelling theme worth exploring?
So I've been studying poverty for my whole career, but I've been studying the poverty of individuals. I wrote a book in 2015 with one of our co-authors, Luke Schaefer, on the lives of the poor, the very poorest Americans. But shortly after that book, which is called $2 a Day, Living on Virtually Nothing in America, a program officer from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation called us up. And she said, would you be willing to turn your lens from America's poorest people to a more America's poorest places? And this was just a revelation, really thinking about the influence of place and not just of things like wages and the safety net and how that influences individual poverty. So we had learned, we were learning just at this point from social science that the place really mattered. In fact, it may have mattered more than genes. It may have mattered more than one's behavior, one's choices. Place had a profound effect on how children turned out as adults. And we were just grappling with this, you know, as social scientists, but we really didn't know how and why place was so influential. So we began by identifying America's most disadvantaged communities, and then we embedded ethnographic researchers in these places and cracked open a lot of history books to begin to understand the hows and the whys of why place played such a profound role in people's life chances.
As I was reading the introduction to the book, And you recount this this story of speaking with this person from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, Andrea Dukas. You say, you know, after kind of thinking about this, we wondered why were so few of our colleagues studying whole communities? Why weren't we? And I for a moment kind of misread that and misunderstood what was being said. And then I kind of realized why I was stumbling on it is because I couldn't believe that this isn't the way that this has been studied. I mean, it just makes all the sense in the world. And it sounds like you were kind of expressing the same thing. Like for all of you, it was kind of this head scratching. What have we been doing here? How could we have missed the importance of this factor and not sort of folded it into our studies and analysis right from the start? I'm still very intrigued by that.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because way back 100 years ago, and especially in the years of the Great Depression, when we had to find things for academics to do, there were many studies of whole communities, and these studies were revelatory. And in fact, we revive some of the insights of these studies in our book. But with the rise of big data, with the rise of massive computing power, with the rise of statistical analyses and surveys and administrative data, it became really appealing to try to predict individual level outcomes rather than place-based outcomes. And also, it's actually hard to prove empirically. It has been hard to prove empirically that place matters because people don't randomly end up in places. So it's only recently that we've gotten the kind of data, both through experiments and through sources like the IRS, that we've been able to demonstrate in a causal way, convincingly, that place matters. So it's very interesting. Everyone kind of assumed 100 years ago that place mattered, and they wrote about it. We sort of forgot that place mattered or couldn't test it, so we ignored it. And now, of course, this really amazing research by both sociologists and economists have really shown convincingly that place has this causal effect. But those findings are a black box. They don't tell us how They don't tell us why, and they especially don't tell us how history has played in to these to the stubbornness of disadvantage in these regions of America that we focus on.
And that's what you seek to uncover and explore in your book. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Catherine J. Eden, who is on the faculty at Princeton University, and she is one of three co-authors of a very important new book called The Injustice of Place, Uncovering the Legacy of Poverty in America. You tell us that one of the first things that you needed to do was get some understanding of how best to measure, well, really not only poverty, I mean poverty in the sense of maybe the purest way in which that term is often used, but a little broader term of disadvantage. And you ultimately came up with something that I think you call the index of deep disadvantage, which weighs a number of different factors beyond just, for instance, income level. Tell us about the crafting of this index of deep disadvantage, the elements that are part of it, and why this is such an important matter when we're talking about something like this.
So a lot of people have long been impatient with income-based measures of poverty. And they're imperfect. People forget to tell surveys about some sources of income. People have in-kind resources they live on in addition to cash. There are all kinds of problems. And it's only an indirect measure of what we really care about, which is well-being. So in moving from poverty to disadvantage, and of course disadvantage was a carefully chosen term, it implies an injustice, an unfairness, that somebody is being held back, not for reasons of one's own choosing. So in moving from poverty to disadvantage, we wanted to capture some of these direct measures of well-being that our nation's data infrastructure has recently generated in great abundance. So in addition to this, these cyclical measures, you know, poverty and deep poverty, which rise and fall with the strength of the economy, we wanted a cumulative measure. And of course, the best cumulative measure that we can apply to all cities and counties in the United States is health. So we looked at health at the beginning and the end of the life course and folded that in to the income measures. And then third, some places have a lot more opportunity than others. If you have a high school degree and you're born in Humphreys County, Mississippi, about the best job you can get is probably in the catfish industry. Whereas if you grow up in some parts of California, you might have much greater opportunity structure. So we looked at really, really fantastic data from the Internal Revenue Service that measured the chances that a poor kid living in a particular place could make it to the middle class as an adult. So we call those structural measures of disadvantage. So putting together these three aspects of disadvantage, the cyclical, the cumulative, and the structural, we were able to generate a score for every city and county in the United States.
And your book includes an intriguing map in which we see through just sort of coloration, county by county, how this breaks out. Tell our listeners about the first surprise for you and your two co-authors in terms of where the most serious disadvantage was immediately visible on this map, immediately apparent.
Yeah. So I grew up in rural Minnesota, but I've really never studied rural poverty. I've spent my career, as have my colleagues, my co-authors on this book, studying urban poverty. So we put these rankings on a map and were astonished by the results. You know, looking back, we shouldn't have been. If you know anything about the history of capitalism in America. This should not have been a surprise. But the greatest, by far the greatest concentrations of deep disadvantage were in rural areas. And furthermore, many of these rural areas were majority minority. They were majority Black. They were majority Hispanic. The exception to that being central Appalachia. So we see this great concentration in four regions, the historic Tobacco Belt, Virginia and the Carolinas, the Cotton Belt running from the Carolinas all the way through Louisiana and Arkansas. South Texas, incredible concentration of deep disadvantage in that region. And then of course Central Appalachia. So these are the areas where disadvantage was strongly concentrated. I should say that though not concentrated geographically for historic regions, many Native nations are also highly disadvantaged. And of course that disadvantage has its own story. We were not able to explore that story in the book, but do talk about it to an extent, and talk about how Native American history and historical exclusion really kind of underlies all of the other historical processes we write about in these other four regions.
You've mentioned this very briefly, but explain in a little more detail what you and your co-authors did in terms of dispatching teams of researchers to learn more about these deeply disadvantaged places across the country.
So these places are almost never researched. And as a consequence, there was not a lot to go on. We chose representative communities in each of these four regions. But we didn't know anything about them going in. They were just typical of the region. And then we embedded teams of graduate students to actually live there, began participating in community life. And we made frequent visits to all of these places, again and again and again, meeting people. But we wanted to move across all four regions as the senior members of the research team. And so we talked to community leaders. We talked to a lot of poor Americans living in these places. We talked to ordinary middle-class people. We went to church potlucks, community festivals, parades, whatever was going on in the community, we tried to be a part of it. People were mistrustful, as you might imagine at first, and so we earned our keep volunteering wherever we could in the local soup kitchen. Or in the local office of the NAACP, helping with grant writing. However our services could be useful to the community, we tried to return some of the generosity that we were ultimately granted by giving back in those ways. So that was an incredibly rich experience, but as we were all in these places and we'd have biweekly or several times weekly, we'd meet by phone. One of the investigators would say, "Did you know that Clay County was once the salt capital of the eastern United States?" And then somebody else would say, "Did you know that it was in Marion, South Carolina, that the bright leaf strain of tobacco was so successfully developed that it led to the widespread adoption of cigarettes? Or did you know that Crystal City, Texas, is known as the spinach capital of the world at one time, producing 80% of the nation's spinach?" And so on. You know, Greenwood, Mississippi, of course, being the center of cotton production after the Civil War. So each of these places were the nation's first or the nation's best or the world's most. And this led us to a central insight, and that is that these places had a lot in common, but they were also really different from other places in the U.S. They shared a history of extraction of resources. Their economies were organized around one industry, cotton, coal, cetera. And they engaged human labor in a way that was so exploitative. It was not seen to the same degree in the rest of the U.S. So these two processes, extraction of a sole commodity and the exploitation of a vast laboring class by only a few elites, were two characteristics that these places had in common. And because of this, we came to call them America's internal colonies.
Hmm. By the way, as you are describing this work, this research work, this, in a sense, infiltration of these various disadvantaged regions of the country, and I do appreciate the way in which you went about, you know, really trying to be a part of these places and really trying to learn as much as you could. You make mention of the COVID-19 pandemic and the fact that, yeah, for understandable reasons, this kind of boots-on-the-ground research was interrupted or had to probably come to a premature halt. But the work did not stop. And in a sense, that encroachment by the pandemic, in a sense, was a blessing in disguise, because in a sense, it allowed this research to go on in a different direction that proved to be very valuable. Can you just describe that to our listeners?
I can literally remember the day when the universities that we were at told us that we could no longer do in-person research. And of course, we kept thinking this would be a week or a month, and it went on and on. And so here we were in our houses. What do academics do when they're stuck at home? They read books. And because of these conversations we'd been having with the ethnographers who are embedded in the communities about the first of this and the nation's leader in that, we thought, you know, we need to get to know the history of these places. And this is also something that social scientists too rarely do. So Princeton Library and the University of Michigan, where we were located, have tremendous library resources. And we were ordering, you know, dissertations from 1917 and reading old WPA guides from the 30s. We read all of the original community studies that had been done anywhere close to these regions up to 100 years ago. It was just an incredible outpouring of data that became available to us from history, even family collections in some cases, family reunions, and, you know, some people self-published these books, and we were able to get a hold of some of those. And so that deepened the research in such a profound way, because we realized that the patterns we were seeing today had deep historical roots. And in fact, these patterns cast 100-150 years ago were indeed determinative of how these places were doing today. And so really the book is about how these distant legacies, what mechanisms are operating that perpetuate these distant legacies in the present day.
We're speaking with Catherine Eden, co-author of a book called The Injustice of Place, Uncovering the Legacy of Poverty in America. It examines those places in America that are mired in a particularly deep, intractable poverty or deep disadvantage, and seeks to understand why poverty has taken hold in such brutal fashion in some of these places, many of them rural America. You've made mention of the fact that these regions of deep disadvantage you like to call America's internal colonies. I think it would be great if you could explain a little further why you think that is the right terminology or a helpful way to think about these parts of America. I mean, in what way are you using that term colony, or what sort of images are you hoping to evoke for us?
So research on the kinds of places we typically think of as colonies, European colonies, have shown that common characteristics of these places are organization around a shared commodity, an elite class that is interested not in investing, but extracting. So, you know, where I grew up in central Minnesota, farmers would rotate their crops because they were investing in the land and investing in the farm. If you look at cotton or tobacco production, these literally tore apart and depleted and destroyed the land. So the people who were cultivating those crops were continually moving west for new land sources. So this theme of extraction rather than investment. Another shared quality of these places is that they had a very few elites, a very few and very, very wealthy elites that were exploiting the labor of a very large number of non-elites. And in those cases, the right to vote, just, you know, living standards, were the access to schooling, basic human rights were either limited or denied. So the story of the labor controls in these places, you know, well after the Civil War, it is quite stunning across all of these regions, these labor controls and these denials of basic human rights and basic suffrage were a very common part of the story. In some cases persist even today. Hmm. So it would have been really foolish if we had seen all of these patterns and it hadn't occurred to us that these look a lot like colonies. And we thought initially, oh, that term is too sensational. We shouldn't use that. And over time, we said, well, we've got to call it as we see it. This is what the data are telling us, and we have to honestly and truthfully report those findings to the public. Hmm.
Your book goes on to explore some of the specific ways, or maybe the specific means by which this disadvantage, this legacy of disadvantage, has been perpetuated over the generations, or entrenched in such powerful ways. And certainly that is very clearly laid out in the second chapter of the book, which is called Separate Unequal, in which you take a look at the really sad state of public schools in all of these deeply disadvantaged areas. I think among the most shocking passages in the entire book is part of this chapter, in which the heading is Before Brown in the Cotton Belt. And this is a portion of the book in which you and your co-authors seek to describe for us what public education meant for the typical black student in the heart of the Cotton Belt before the groundbreaking Supreme Court ruling. I don't think we have time to outline every single thing, but give our listeners some sense of just the staggering injustice that we see in terms of public education being delivered to black youngsters in the heart of the Cotton Belt.
Well, as you might imagine, and this is true also in South Texas, blacks and whites were segregated by law. They went to separate schools. Black parents had to provide the facility for the black schools. They were not provided by the state the way that white schools were. Black students didn't have transportation to school, whereas white students got to take the bus. They had severely inadequate and unprepared instruction. There were often no chalkboards or any materials in these schools. And most profoundly of all, these children were expected to work. And so the white school boards, white-controlled school boards, would decide how many months school was going to last, and often that was only 5 or 6 months. And, of course, the problem was that kids weren't learning enough to pass on to the next grade, yet they had to pass on to the next grade. So the rates of adult illiteracy, even today, are astonishingly high in these places. And maybe most in cities of all, where there were high schools that served Black students, oftentimes there was no 12th grade, which meant they couldn't go to college unless they could finance their 12th grade education at a boarding school. So these are all just striking ways. And many of these same patterns persisted well into the 1970s, because Brown was not enforced until the 70s.
Right.
In many of these places.
Absolutely. You mentioned, for instance, how segregation remained deeply entrenched, you know, even years after this Supreme Court decision. Three states in particular, I think you tell us, Mississippi, Alabama, and South Carolina, years after that, still had not one single integrated classroom. Another part of this story, and this is a part of the story I knew nothing about until I read your book, is the rise of what you call segregation academies. And this would be something that would emerge in the wake of Brown versus the Board of Education, in which the whites were seeking to preserve the disparities that were already in place. Explain what these segregation academies were, and to this day are.
So we discovered segregation academies by driving through as many of these places as we could. We'd go to the local courthouse. We'd talk with folks, at the local cafe. We went to 175 of the most deeply disadvantaged communities in the country in the spring of 2021. And we kept finding these schools. The Robert E. Lee Academy, founded 1969, or the So-and-So Academy, founded 1972, and they were scattered all over the Cotton Belt South. So what we learned is that when Brown began to actually be enforced in the late 60s and 70s across the Deep South, the White Citizens Council was very influential in teaching white parents how to set up their own segregation schools. And in fact, in the book, we have a photo image of the cover of the White Citizens Council publication with step-by-step instructions. So these sprung up, I mean, thousands of them sprung up all over the South, more than a dozen in Memphis alone, often under the auspices of the Baptists or the Presbyterians or even the Seventh-day Adventists. So churches don't play such a great role here. But over and over again, what we saw is white students withdrawing to these schools and initially with state support. So often they would take the school mascot with them. The textbooks would suddenly end up in the segregation school. The whole, spirit of these public schools was appropriated by these segregation schools, leaving only Black pupils in their wake. And then, of course, once the whites, who were the haves, the minorities in these places, withdrew their children, they also withdrew their support for bond issues and school funding initiatives. And in the schools that remained, there was a real race to the bottom.
Right.
And these segregation schools weren't very good either. So everyone lost. And new economic research suggests that for those places that did integrate, white students weren't hurt at all. And this is the work of Rucker Johnson, an economist at Berkeley. Whereas the black-white test score gap in achievement evaporated. So the South and white parents in the South did everyone a disservice, including your own children, by creating these segregation academies. And many of them remain. And they may have one or two black students, but there many have none. A couple have seen the light. There's one in Greenville, Mississippi, that is now, I think this is a pandemic story. They needed those football players from the public schools that closed and didn't have a football season, but they now have a substantial number of black students. But for the most part, segregation academies are still a reality across the South.
And you tell us that only very, very rarely would they be explicit. I mean, it's not like it's going to say segregation academy over the entrance. But, you know, this is a term that embodies what, in fact, their intent was. And you also tell us that they came in, there are various types. I mean, we kind of immediately think of beautiful buildings, well-appointed lawns, and well-paid staff, and so on. And that would be a certain kind of segregation academy. But there were also segregation academies created for poor white students. And those, that would be a very different kind of private school, but created with essentially the same intention.
Yeah, and Wikipedia, by the way, has done a really good job of labeling these schools as segregation academies. So you look at the founding year. but what's interesting is in their mission statements, they often refer to, we are concerned about the quality of education that our students receive. Educational quality was often sort of a cloak for justifying this fleeing of white students from the public schools. Hmm. So there are these code words, right, integrity and the morality of our students that are very much reflective of the lost cause. And so it's really interesting to look at the mission statements of these schools.
Right. Beyond the realm of education, your book shares some of the findings of your research teams in other matters, and one of the most pervasive scourges in these areas of deep disadvantage concerns the opioid drug epidemic, which we have heard so much about, and which very likely the COVID-19 pandemic made even worse. And one of the most striking findings in terms of a reason for it is actually the title of your third chapter, Nothing to Do Here But Drugs. Tell us the sad reality that is behind those simple words.
When we got to Central Appalachia, we had no idea that we had selected one of the counties that was the epicenter of the opioid crisis. And everybody in town had a diagnosis for why this was happening there. And they kept telling us over and over again, well, the reason the kids are using drugs is there's nothing to do here but drugs. And then they would tell us about the bowling alley that had closed, and the roller rink that had closed, and the movie theater that had become now a local Pentecostal church and wasn't open to the public, the beauty salons and barbershops that had once populated downtown, but had disappeared. And we were like, oh, come on, this can't be important. But as we were there, you know, this is why living in a place is so important. We began to take this idea seriously. And we wondered, could it be that when a place like Clay County, where we were, loses the institutions that allow community members to gather and form social bonds, could it be when those disappear that the safety net of that community is torn apart? Could it be that these ordinary things like movie theaters are actually vital social infrastructure that are as important, that are as life or death a matter as the physical infrastructure we're very good at investing in, like roads and bridges? Mm-hmm. And so we've turned to the nation's data infrastructure. Again, the Census Bureau runs a census of U.S. businesses. The data are far from perfect. Another research team conducted a similar analysis using different data. But in both cases, we found a very strong relationship between the decline in social infrastructure over time in a county and the rise of its rate of death due to opioids, overdose deaths. So this was really striking factor. And of course, government agencies are generally, by statute, not allowed to invest in social infrastructure. Their mandate is economic development and physical infrastructure, and of course, that's very important. You know, in the United States right now, due to recent government actions, we have more money available for rural investment than perhaps ever in history. However, none of these resources, or very few of these resources, can flow to this critical form of infrastructure that is a life and arguably a life and death matter for American communities, and manifests itself in things like high rates of overdose deaths.
Hmm. Closely related, of course, is the scourge of violence, which is in part of the story of these deeply disadvantaged regions. But I want to leap ahead to Chapter 5, which is called Little Kingdoms. And this explores the scourge of corruption, public corruption, that is often a part of some of these communities. What would be one example that you'd want to share of that with our listeners today?
Yeah, when we think of rural disadvantage, corruption is just not part of the conversation. Sometimes we talk about corruption of the political machines in cities, but what's less known is that America's most disadvantaged regions are among the most corrupt in the United States, consistently year after year ranking in states that rank very, very high in public corruption. And what we learned from our historical analysis is this goes back generations. It is the way in which the original elite families, those salt barons, you know, in central Appalachia, the cotton barons of the tobacco barons, the spinach barons of South Texas, maintain power. So very early on, they learned that the key to getting power was to combine large, massive land ownership with holding elected office, initially locally, but sometimes stretching all the way up to, in the case of Clay County, one of the original founding families put a family member in as Speaker of the House of the U.S. House of Representatives. So through political power and, you know, utter economic and total economic control, these elites have maintained power, and their descendants have maintained power even today. And so the same families, the same family names, come up over and over again in looking at who is in the powerful positions at present. And the most famous story I'll tell, of course, is that of the Mississippi welfare scandal, in which a huge, you know, millions and millions, I think at last count it was $80 million, designated by the federal government for the poorest children in America who live in Mississippi, ends up in the pockets of celebrity athletes, Brett Favre and others in the state, and used for pet projects like volleyball stadiums at his alma mater. So that story has gotten some play in the national media, mostly because it involved a former NFL quarterback. But it is the largest public corruption scandal in the state's history. And, of course, the person who conspired with government officials to launch that scheme was from none other than LaFleur County, Mississippi, in the city of Greenwood, which was the center of the great internal colony of the Cotton Belt that ruled after the Civil War.
Right. Yeah, you described this in fascinating detail, calling it a sprawling public embezzlement scheme of just, kind of staggering proportions. And you write later in this chapter, corruption is a common theme across America's internal colonies and is a key mechanism through which the sins of the past continue to wreak havoc on these places today. I do want to make sure to have people understand that your book includes a chapter that I'm afraid we don't have time to talk about called Revolt and Retribution, which does mention those relatively rare instances when, in a sense, people have tried to rise up in the face of this kind of injustice. And you tell us about that, as well as the painful retribution which they faced. But maybe most importantly, I want to be sure that people know that the final chapter of your book, called Healing America's Internal Colonies, states some potential paths towards maybe rectifying some of this terrible injustice and inequality. Do you want to just, we just have a couple of minutes, but do you want to highlight at least a couple of the things that would be at least a fruitful starting point?
We would love for readers to look at this chapter. For each of the mechanisms that we outline, schooling, social infrastructure, violence, corruption, and so on, we offer specific remedies. And there are a mix of, here's what we really ought to do, if we want to ultimately solve this problem. But there are also a whole menu of very tractable things people can do right now. So you can, ending segregation in schooling, American schools are now as segregated as they were in the 60s. So it's a huge problem. That is a tall order, something we should relentlessly pursue. But increasing teacher pay can have dramatic results in the classrooms we have right now. So that's an example of what this chapter is about. We absolutely must end public corruption, but a lot of the ways the federal government gives money to locales invites it. So we could easily think of strategies that ensure that we avoid lining the pockets of the elites when we try to invest in rural communities. Violence. Well, the story we tell about violence in the book really suggests that if you want to curb violence, you have to ensure mobility. I'm part of the conversation about anti-violence programs in America, but rarely do we say what young people really need is hope. They need hope that they, just because they're born poor, doesn't mean they can't make it to the middle class. So restoring opportunity, making sure there are ladders of opportunity, is actually as important to curbing violence as the presence of police enforcement on the street. And in fact, our big data analysis of this suggests it may be more important than the presence of the police.
Your book gives us so much to think about, and I trust that everybody hearing this interview will seek out your book and explore it as I have. The book is, again, titled The Injustice of Place, Uncovering the Legacy of Poverty in America, published by Mariner Books, and one of its authors, Catherine Eden. Professor Eden, thank you so much for giving the world this really important book. Congratulations on the great work you and your team did. And best wishes with all of your future work on this really important topic.
I really appreciate your careful read. That was just an excellent interview. That was a real joy.
Now, 8:59, this is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. NPR News and classical music on your gateway to public radio. I'm Dave McGrath. We'll join the news at 9:01, and then we will have Wisconsin Public Radio's classical music programming through the morning, and then we're back at noon with the WGTD Midday News. Let's check the forecast details now from the National Weather Service. Lovely day today. It's going to be a pretty nice week all in all.